So I was standing there naked, buck naked, and waiting and waiting. The air was warm, so I wasn't really physically uncomfortable, but I was getting a little anxious. So I reached down, felt the water, and sure enough, it was still cold. Turned the temperature up a little bit more. Still cold. Turned it up a bit more. Still cold. That process went on for a bit. Finally got it where I think I hit it. Temperature was just right. Step right on into the shower. Start lathering up. And boom, it's way too hot. And I'm right back out of the shower. So I turn the water back down again. And this time I know there's a delay, right? So I'm turning it down. I'm real careful. But still, I overshoot. And now it's too cold. I get it finally tuned in. And I get my shower. Now, I tell you that story because feedback and time to feedback is critical in a lot of areas in life. Requirements most of all, but just look at the shower, right? I wasted a bunch of time. Right? So if you look at the iron triangle, right, there's time. I wasted a lot of resources. There's some water flowing out here. I'm losing water. And frankly, I reduced my scope as well because I didn't get to hang out in the shower long enough to really relax before I had to go speak at a conference. So these things, this feedback can kill you. And that's what I'd like to talk about today. We're going to focus the day on this feedback and this responsiveness that we need when we have a requirement till the time we can get that requirement back and act on it, understand about it. Maybe it's just a PowerPoint storyboard that you hand to somebody that they can review. Or maybe it's looking out and having a mock-up out on the web. Or maybe it's getting feedback from actual customers when you've deployed. So managing requirements and user expectations in agile projects. And we're going to focus on that, kind of align it with that feedback metaphor throughout. My name's Stephen Borg. I'm the co-founder and strategist at a company called Northwest Cadence. And that's my email right there. I also have some business cards if you're interested. Feel free to shoot me an email anytime if you've got questions around requirements or whatnot. So today, we're going to go through a few things. So our agenda today, we already covered nudity. So I think we're okay. We got a few more topics to cover. We got the circle of love, some unintended humor, simplicity, forgiveness, and pillow talk. And that should bring us to the end. Now, I plan to leave room for questions. So if you have questions, I welcome them all the way throughout the presentation. It's about 15 minutes of questions before I have to start rushing demos. So I'll kind of keep track of that. I worked for a while at Microsoft, not as an employee, but as a contractor. And one of the folks that I worked with ran the marketing for the Application Lifecycle Management, ALM. His name's Karthik Ravindran, and he's one of my mentors and a friend. I really appreciate him. And I was sitting in the office, and he came in absolutely quietly, just wandered in, stood at the whiteboard with his back to me, looking at the whiteboard, didn't say a word, picked up a pen, and drew a circle with an arrow on the top. Then he sat there for a moment longer, and he turned and he said, "I think we have the right metaphor for ALM." And then he proceeded to describe the circle of love, which is what it kind of came to be known amongst the people there at Microsoft. And I'd like to talk about the circle of love, because I think it's an interesting thing. And it's all about reducing cycle time, and we want to do that more than just in that development arena. And this is the circle of love, and you may have seen it here before. We go through several phases, right? Define, where we're getting our requirements together, development, where we're coding, testing, getting ready for production, and then pushing to prod. Once we're in prod, we expect to get some good learning from there as well. So we're going to measure here as well. Now, a guy named Dave West from Forrester coined a term that I think nails this. It's called water scrum fall, the reality in most organizations today. We're good at that develop phase. We've got it nailed. Your development teams, it's not everyone's there yet, but we have the skills, and your development teams are churning out code on this 1 week or 2 week cadence that's fully tested, ready to go to production. But we've got the waterfall on both ends. We got the waterfall up front where we're gathering all these requirements, big nice document, and we hand it to the devs who decompose it to user stories and bam, 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 finish it up in these nice tight iterations where it goes and sits waiting until all of them features are done before operations pushes it to production. Water, scrum, fall. Now, I'm not here to talk about the whole cycle, but let's look at what's happening. Who here has heard of the word DevOps? Has heard of DevOps? Who here hasn't? You didn't raise your hand. That's a binary question. It's got to be one or the other. So, just testing how participative the audience will be. DevOps, the people in operations are figuring it out. They're aligning with development to release on a very fast cadence. Requirements is not yet on board. We don't have BA dev, or whatever that fancy term will be eventually, as we're getting stuff from the business analysts into that pipeline fast. Now, the key about the circle of love and what makes it so valuable is we produce a requirement, go through, get feedback on the requirement, and use it to drive further learning. And what we want to do is take that time, that cycle time, and shrink that loop, and continue shrinking that loop, so we can get very, very fast feedback. What that means is we can spend more time in the shower. Right? Because you've got that feedback loop tight, we can get that requirement in, get feedback. If we've got it wrong, we can fix it, and we don't build on all that bad stuff. Requirements is often a mess. So another story. A company I worked with about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, the business analysts had giant requirements, right? 60, 80, sometimes more than 100 pages. And they were moving to this agile approach to delivering software. And it was very interesting because the developers wanted nice, tight things. They looked at the requirements and they couldn't even understand exactly how everything fit together because it was too complex. There's too much to get in your head in an 80-page document and know how to code. So they were coding it, and they would almost always be wrong. And that life cycle to get that 180-page requirement through was 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks. So by the time the users looked at it and told them it was wrong, they'd been going down a path for a long time. What makes this story interesting is that agile stuff started to bubble up, and the CIO heard of something called acceptance criteria. Familiar? Right? If you do user stories, you have this acceptance criteria. It's almost a checklist of things that you need to do to satisfy the requirement. What's beautiful about them is it lets the developers know when they're done coding, and it lets the testers know what to test. So he thought this was a great idea. And in the meeting, they have a monthly meeting, and in that meeting, the devs, testers, BAs were all sitting around. It's very informal. And the CIO said, you know, we're going to make a change. In the requirements documents, we're going to put, at the end, the acceptance criteria, everything that needs to be done that we can validate that requirement. Pause. About 1/10 of a second. And some BA jumps up and says, wait, that's way too complicated. We'll never be able to figure that out. Another pause. About a second, and the devs just roared because they understood if you who gathered the requirement can't figure it out, how are we supposed to code it effectively to meet those requirements? It turned out that after about 3 months, the BAs who'd been saying, we cannot not break those down any further, these are the smallest possible requirements, were delivering user stories. Why? Small enough so they could understand, get a little chunk off. So we need to make sure that our requirements are right-sized, that they're not these big, giant things, but that they're small enough that they can be consumed. But if you're in an enterprise, that's easier said than done, necessarily. If I look at that, it pains me. This is not a user story. Executives don't do user stories, right? If you saw that, What are your acceptance criteria? How do you know what you should do? It's too general. So as we look at the environment, you're going to see that realistically, requirements is different. The requirements are different at every level of the organization. I've broken it into three. You might have many more here. But if we start at the team level, those requirements are small, easily doable, get them out the door, check them off a backlog, and move on. We step up to a little bit larger level, and we're looking at features or epics at that management level. And they may roll up. You may have a couple levels there. But at the executive level, you've got things like vision and initiatives. And those things are best not expressed as a user story. But just because they're different doesn't mean they're not related. So one of the things we'll talk about in just a moment is this decomposition. It might be a many-to-many relationship, but in general, if you can avoid it, a nice decomposition from what is happening at the top to what is happening at the bottom is beautiful. We can keep those related on the way through. So let's start with team requirements. This is where, if you're coming here and you saw agile requirements, you're probably most comfortable. This is what you came to hear about, potentially. Team requirements really fall well into this concept of a user story. That's not the only way to do requirements, but it's a nice way. User stories make a really excellent choice. Very often, they're framed in this thing. As a role, I want some activity so that some value. And they're traditionally made up of three things: card, confirmation, and conversation, or an invitation to a conversation. And this is the interesting thing with these. Rather than give me a document that's very large and big that tries to express absolutely everything, give me a much smaller document. In fact, give me one that'll fit on a 3x5 card, maybe a 4x6 card. Like this. As a tech ed attendee, I want to quickly provide session ratings so that I can provide effective feedback and improve future events. And we've got clear acceptance criteria. As a developer, I can pull that card off, and I can code it. And I understand what I need to do to be sure that I'm done coding it. There's probably going to be more acceptance criteria here. And as a tester, I'm able to go back and look at the acceptance criteria and turn some of those, potentially, into tests, be they manual tests or automated tests. So we can kind of get that flow going. What makes agile requirements at this level different than most requirements is the conversation piece. It's an invitation to a conversation. So your business analysts have a choice. They can interview and really understand what the business needs are, and then they can spend 2 weeks, 3 weeks writing a big giant requirement that they think captures everything. Or they can spit out maybe 30 or 40 of these and take that remaining time and use it to interact tightly with the development team when the development team asks questions. So BAs among you, how many BAs do we have? If you don't make yourself available to your developers on a regular basis, you're slowing down their feedback cycle. They need to get something from you, some way to build something, and they can get stopped by you. So make sure you're available. And you do that by potentially reducing the amount of data you're dropping into those requirements. The funny thing is about those requirements, most of the stuff in them, a lot of it's not actually required. You know, a lot of stuff that goes in there is just you clump in all the nice-to-haves, you clump in everything, and you have one big document. So you may need to slip that out. Any questions on these? I'm not going to dive into them too deeply. They're covered everywhere. Mike Cohn has a brilliant book on requirements, on agile user stories. Good book. I'll forward you there. Now let's step up to management. Now at the management level, we might rely on things like user stories. At this point, they're often an excellent choice, but they're generally a little more vague. So you're going to see something like the tech ed planner here who just wants a good rating system. Well, that's a little harder, but it's a higher level that's then decomposed. The acceptance criteria tends to not necessarily be able to be turned into firm, executable tests. Except that second one, that one can. So some, it's a kind of a mix. Using user stories at this level, often a very good idea. However, once you get to that level of management, it's now more difficult for a developer to pick up the phone, call that individual and say, hey, what about X? So they're losing that very fast feedback cycle that they have down at the user story level. So sometimes you'll find a little bit more documentation. A lot of the people I talked to out here said, we're between this waterfall and agile. We're kind of in between and we're trying to bridge that gap with the traditional and agile development. What I'm saying here is that there is a balance that needs to be struck. You can go pick up the user, user story books, and if you think you can drive user stories all the way up to the top part of your organization, you're probably going to not be very successful. There's still a balance that needs to be struck, even with agility. But notice, we're still small requirements. Now, as we step up to the executive level, things change a little bit more. At the executive level, you're looking more at portfolio management. Where are we going to place our investments? Who are we going to fund? Looking at change management initiatives, governance, those sorts of things. And at this level, that backlog metaphor does not work, or it begins to break down dramatically. So you, in Agile, you often have a prioritized backlog. You grab the top thing off of it. You specify it. Do a business analysis. You code it. You test it together. And then you deploy it, and you get feedback right away. And then you grab the next thing. At the executive level, that doesn't always work. They often now, instead of using a backlog metaphor, you're going to use a portfolio metaphor, where you're starting to spread your resources across several different initiatives. And that's just the nature of the beast. A company can't just be focused on what makes it profitable now. It needs to be focused on R&D, future investments, etc. And the backlog metaphor doesn't always work well for that. But it might. You have to see your organizations. The requirements here tend to look completely unlike anything beneath them. But I want to give you an example of one that's potentially useful. It's the A3 problem-solving method. Anyone here use that? A3, how do you like it? Still getting used to it, but it's helping. A3 is it's a type of paper, right? Approximately, for Americans, it's 11 by 17 inches. It's that nice big piece of paper. And all of your decision-making thought process ends up on a single A3. Now, this A3 is one that just happens to be under a branching strategy, a change to a branching strategy. But we have a background. We have some current conditions, some targets, a hypothesis on where we want to move the business. We also have identified some risks. What will the workflow look like? And all of that, this is an actual one that made its way up to the executive level management inside of an organization looking to change the way their teams built software. And that's something you can bring to an executive. They can look at, understand, and they have the background, the context, the potential risks that will be involved. How are we going to mitigate those risks? I mean, if you look up here, we've got risk mitigation strategies on each of these. So the A3 document keeps it very tight. It forces you to put everything on that one page, and off you go. Now, a lot of people are going to say, not a chance. No way we can put that level of decision on a single piece of paper. I disagree. The Toyota Prius, the justification for the Toyota Prius that spent 2 years building the appropriate A3 for as it flowed through Toyota, ended up on an A3 piece of paper that people would discuss. Now, does that mean all possible knowledge is in the A3? Absolutely not. And there might be A3s at lower levels as well, justifying deeper things potentially. But the idea is keep it tight and understandable. If you're a business analyst and you don't want to go to an A3, your goal should still be to keep that as tight as possible. Because the more you put in, the more complex it becomes, and you're starting to establish rules around things. Any questions on that? Does that metaphor strike anyone as reasonable or unreasonable at this, at that level. For those waterfall folks, the traditional, no pushback. Outstanding. Well, then let's jump over to Team Foundation Server and let's take a look at what that might look like in TFS. Now, you've all seen the TFS stuff here, potentially, so I'm not going to focus on all the cool features of TFS, but I do want to show how these things potentially break down. So right here, if I go and take a look at my backlog, and this is my Agile team that's building stuff. Let me look at my backlog. And you can see we've got some stories that I'm working on my backlog. Things like submit session ratings online, request update emails to session abstract submitters, etc. I've got a whole bunch of these. And these user stories are down at the team level. They're what I'm going to be able to use to make sure that as a developer, I can code these things. As a tester, I can test them. And as a product owner, I can sign off on them as they go into production piece by piece by piece. Let's take a look at one of them, at session ratings here at the lower level. Let's open it up. And you can see what types of things you find inside of one of these user stories. So submit session ratings online, kind of an interesting area you might find. Right down here, here's we have our as a blah, blah, blah. Our acceptance criteria that you saw earlier is listed. It's just right in here. And there's some extra stuff here. I want to stress, if you know something extra beyond the acceptance criteria, by all means, type it in. We're not opposed to having good information there. We just don't want to be overwhelmed by it as a developer. We want just enough to do the right thing. And we've got some other things, story points, etc. But I think there's a couple interesting pieces here. There's a storyboard up in the upper left, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. It helps maybe visualize things. And we've got some test cases. And we've got some other links. I want to take a look at the test cases. Because what happens in TFS is you take these test cases and potentially, I mean those acceptance criteria, and potentially turn them into test cases that the developers can then run before they check in their code to validate. I love this, folks. How many of you, the testers are after the developers? So you have BA tester dev. BA dev tester. A lot. That metaphor causes all sorts of difficulties if the testers aren't looking at the code until after the developers do something with it. Here's why. BA writes up some stuff. Developer codes up the application and hands it to the tester. What does the tester test? They test the application. They put their brain power against finding bugs in the application. So what we have is the BAs have a beautiful view of the requirements. The devs take that view and they translate it into a technical solution to that business problem. And the testers test the technical solution. That's the wrong approach. The testers should be up front looking at the business requirements and building the tests around the business view. So you have the business view. You have a tester view trying to break it, the technical view, and then they come back together as we go into deployment because the testers are now looking at the production code or the ready for production code through a different lens, through the business lens. Is this the right code, not did someone forget a semicolon? And I think that's kind of the important thing there. So anyway, that flow through. So these test cases, I like to see them up early. I love to see developers walking through the test cases before they push the code to the testers. Testers then, they get the code, they're like, hey, it's already passed a bunch of tests, now let's go in and do some real testing. They might dive in a little bit more deeply, but that's that approach right there. The problem we have, however, with this is that we need to submit our session ratings online. How does that roll up? What bigger thing are we looking at? And if we roll up here to features, we can see that we have a couple features that we're working with. So we've got create effective session and speaker rating system, and we've got provide session abstracts online. Two things that we're working on. And if we open up this feature, you can see that it has, again, the acceptance criteria as well as some of the key elements that we're looking at. If we look at its links, notice it has a bunch of child user stories. These are the user stories that belong to it. These are the things that roll up for completion here. That all makes sense? Now, the nice thing is, remember that we saw that image in the PowerPoint of kind of all the teams working at the bottom, and it rolling up to kind of a management level, and then rolling up to an executive level? I'm not rolling it to an executive level here, predominantly because they only implemented features right now. You'd have to do a little extra work to make it show up at the executive level. But I do want to talk a little bit about how those that decomposition should occur. We have teams in TFS. I don't want to make this a TFS talk, but I highly encourage you in your organizations, as you're moving to agility, let teams figure out their process on their own. Don't impose a massive process that everyone has to use. Instead, provide guidance about what each level needs and let the teams underneath them figure out that process on their own. Let me give you an example. I've got two teams here, one team called Foo and one team called Bar. It's classic developer things, right? So if I go to the Foo backlog, you'll know that everything has to do with ratings. They're building the rating system. So the Foo people are building the rating system here, and the Bar people are building some of the other things. But over here, if I look at my board, I can see how are my Foo people tracking data. My Foo people are tracking it by a relatively complicated thing. I've got to do, next in line, design, dev, test, ready for deployment, and closed. So I've got a lot of steps that I'm going through by these guys. Okay? Now, that's great for them. That's where they want to be. But if I look over at the Bar group, you'll see that the Bar's board is completely different. To do, doing. They had to have something in there for user acceptance testing, and then they're done. Basically, to do, doing, done. Much, much simpler. All of a sudden, however, we've got a conflict. How do we manage requirements at the higher level? If I step up and look at the board above, you'll see that TFS is able to translate those up so that we have this very nice board with new, active, resolved, and closed. A different one, but is completely related to what's happening underneath. Each team tracks the way they want to track, and then it rolls up. Some teams might be doing Kanban. Some teams might be doing Scrum. Some teams might be doing Spiral. I had a company call me and say, "We're all waterfall." I said, "Great. You're looking to move to Agile, yep. How often do you ship to production?" Thursday. Thinking, okay, well, maybe they got a really big backlog and it takes 6 months. And they said, no. We come up with what we're going to build on Friday, and then we ship it on Thursday. And you're waterfall. They're like, yes, because we go through analysis, development, test, production. I'm like, oh, for crying out loud. Agile teams would love to be where you're at. They had some legitimate things, which their testing was disconnected from their dev, and they wanted to bring them together. But it's interesting. Anyway. So that helps roll up across that. Yeah, question? The question is, when I'm switching between Foo and Bar, are they different team projects, or is this a team feature? I'm using the team feature. Yes, you can customize the board per team. So if I'm here at the highest level, I can just customize the columns. And I don't like the word new. I like the word to do. So I'm just going to make this to do. We can change the names there. You can insert columns, remove columns, et cetera. So do the underlying states have to be shared? Yes, the underlying states remain the same. And that's one of the things that allows us to map those so successfully. Thanks for the question. All right. Next thing, when you're being agile, requirements decay at different levels, different speeds. So Capers-Jones, a great guy that runs a lot of metrics on software, he says that 6% of requirements change every month. So if you plan your requirements out a year, you've got an awful lot of change by the time you finally get there to build them. I mean, so much change that it's probably not even worth building them. So as a BA, don't put a whole lot of effort into something that's not going to be delivered for a year, 6 months even. Keep it to a month, 2 months. So down at this team level, we're looking at having requirements there, user stories there, that are completed in kind of that 2 to 4 week time frame. Don't put more on the backlog than you can handle in about that time frame. Now, potentially, you might get to 6 weeks, 7 weeks, but keep it. Try to keep it at that 2 to 4 weeks is usually pretty good. At the management level, you're looking kind of that 2 to 6 month range with a preference to the shorter time scales. And then up at the top at the executive vision, you're looking at kind of that 6 month time frame. Some companies only do planning once a year and they fund everything for the whole year. Oh my goodness, you miss out on some big opportunities if you're not able to adjust. So I recommend at least quarterly meetings or potentially half-yearly meetings so that you can adjust to market conditions even at the executive level, depending on how far up that is. Next, implementation of requirements. Remember, there's this fast feedback we need. We need to get a requirement, build it, and deliver it. But delivering requirements is tricky. And how do I know, if I'm at the management level, how do I know that the executives aren't shafting me by giving me requirements that are completely unspecified and I have no idea what's going on? If you have this framework, and I want to describe a little framework that I found to be very powerful, which is Scrum at the bottom for your dev teams, potentially Kanban, and then Kanban visualizations going up. And as we start moving into the initial Kanban at the top, from to-do over to doing, management defines here. Management says, in order for you to move something from to-do to doing, you need to give me this. Because they're the ones that are going to have to build it. So they need to give you that. As we look over here, the exec level defines done. What does it mean for the management people to be done? Why? Because they're accepting the work up. So it just follows up and down on that approach. Is there any questions on that? It's either very confusing or I beat it to death. Hearing none. That responsibility is relatively distributed. I think this is a really good metaphor. Not even a metaphor. It's a good plan. How many of you have project portfolio planning systems? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We're going to come back to that. This does not look nearly as complicated. It looks like it might be underpowered. So we're going to talk about that in a moment. But this way of doing things, of progressively going up and decomposing your requirements and keeping them linked, is so simple. So simple and so easy to put into practice. If you're going to have hierarchies of requirements and you're making this transition from traditional to agile, there's a tool you can use called Integrate. And I'm not going to go into a full demo here. I'm going to go a PowerPoint demo, if you would. But just kind of go through quickly and show some of the areas here that Integrate solves. It's a plugin that sits on top of Team Foundation Server. So if you're not using TFS, it's not quite an appropriate one. But if you notice here, it's full-featured support for requirements end-to-end. So you've got, down the side here, you can see you've got all of your kind of traditional project and your traditional requirements management tools. I'm still going to tell you to keep it light, really, really light. So Integrate will do the very, very heavyweight stuff as well, but it can also transition very smoothly to this light metaphor. It's got a full requirement hierarchy support that goes back and forth with TFS, very clean. Unlike TFS, innately supports the many-to-many type of requirements linkages you might have. And I kind of think this is interesting. And one of the difficulties new BAs have is just understanding, how do I start interviewing folks? How do I start understanding? And there's a methodology that Integrate has licensed that provides like just a bunch of questions that can help you start guiding you on that process of eliciting requirements. And another thing I like about it is this matrix, this visual traceability between all of your requirements and how they're tied together. You have kind of that mind map view, but you also have the traditional matrix view, and you can see it that way. Okay. That hierarchy when we go into companies and start implementing enterprise agile adoptions, that hierarchy gets a lot of pushback. And the primary pushback it gets is that is not complicated enough to handle our business needs. We are much more sophisticated here. We need that portfolio management system. And that portfolio management system is going to drive all these changes. We've got to know, we got to put in hours that everyone's going to work for the next 2 years. We're going to put in all this details. We're going to say how much money we're going to make from it. We're going to put in so we can calculate ROI. All these things are going to go into that tool. And that tool then, we push a button and it organizes for us what our initiatives should be at the company level and what projects we should be running. And that's true. That tool, those tools will do that. But in 1980, America was getting its rear end kicked by Japanese manufacturing. And Toyota in particular, was coming right up against General Motors in delivering really good cars. They were still doing the smaller cars, but they were delivering them so fast, so effectively, and at such high quality that it was freaking people in America out. So they sent a team, MIT sent a team of experts over to interview a lot of the folks over in Japan and figure out how they were doing it. And that's where the lean movement kind of came from initially. But what they discovered was a comparison between General Motors and Toyota in the way they handled their internal supply chain. General Motors was stinky rich. Man, they had so much money. And they bought this giant ERP system, this enterprise resource planning system, that planned, you'd type in exactly how fast each machine would stamp out parts, how fast each person could assemble them, and it would determine throughout the entire factory the primary way to optimize delivery of goods to each of those areas, to each of the workstations, so they could build. And this big, very complicated system cost them a lot of money, but it optimized them for them, right? It did a lot of advanced mathematics to optimize. Toyota, on the other hand, had no money like that. So use a little cart. You throw a bunch of parts on the cart. You throw 30 parts on the cart, and you throw 30 cards on the part, on the cart, and you wheel it over to the station. And someone grabs a headlamp off, and they take the card, and they just throw it into a container. Just throw it over somewhere into a little bucket, a little box. And then they put the headlight on. They grab the next headlight, throw the card in. Somebody periodically walks by, picks up those cards, carries them on over, grabs more headlights, and brings them back. Now, if there's a blockage, if something bad happens at that workstation, what happens is I stop doing things. I stop needing immediately after me, whatever's after me, stops needing their supplies to be refilled. In Toyota, that information, that blockage information, to say stop sending in parts and stuff, the American researchers found out happened 200 times faster than at General Motors. In other words, when General Motors had a work stoppage, they were still hauling in piles and piles of inventory and packing it up on the floor because their ERP system told them to. And they did it for hours before they finally got the information back and could stop it and change it and start reprogramming. At Toyota, it just happened automatically based on this Kanban system, a pull system. Simplicity allowed them to deliver, by 2008, allowed them to deliver the same amount of cars as General Motors. They just crossed over a little bit bigger in 2008 with 10% of the inventory, the difference between a $2 billion profit and a $5 billion loss. Simplicity is powerful. Don't discount simplicity simply because it doesn't look like this big, giant thing that you've got. Keep it simple. Think about it in a simple approach, because simple approaches force you to think about the solution and understand the solution. There's a kind of an old saw, right? It's better to ask for forgiveness than wait for permission. Yeah, sometimes that doesn't work. You know, law enforcement, that kind of stuff. There's times when you probably want to ask for permission first. But it's got a nugget of some really important stuff when you start talking about agile development. We want to act fast and get feedback. Now let's go back to the dev team level and talk about that dev team level. I want to be able to just reach out, grab a requirement, start coding on it. Oh, for crying out loud, what did they mean by this? Pick up the phone. I call Cheryl, and Cheryl says, oh, I meant this. When I said red, I really meant, give me another color for red. Maroon. I really meant maroon. I was stuck at red. I appreciate it. So I all of a sudden get that immediately fast feedback. But what if Cheryl's not there? Do I stop and wait and get permission, get the actual color that she forgot to type in there? No. You code it up with red or blue or whatever it is. You move fast, get the feedback cycle going very, very rapidly, and get it back to understanding what we're trying to, get it back to the user, who the user can say, oh, for crying out loud, that's not maroon. Oh, well, cascading style sheet, make a quick change, and I'm done. It is better to build something wrong fast in a lot of times than it is to build something right over a long period of time. I'm even going to make an assertion. I'll assert that if you have a project plan, and that project plan is a work breakdown structure that lasts 12 months, and you've got a great dev team and a great PM team, and you drive that thing perfectly, every single one of the tasks hits right on target, and you deliver exactly on that date that you promised, I will assert that your project is either failed or is delivering a lot less value than it should. Because if you have learned nothing that's going to change your plan over the course of a year, you are not paying attention to your marketplace. If requirements change 6% a month, that's a lot of changes in that year. What we want to do is build very small things and get the feedback. Martin Hinchelwood, a guy I work with, he's big on this. He's like, I'm like, well, if there's a requirements change, and he's like, there should never be a requirements change. It's just a new requirement. Deliver your requirements faster than your customers can change their minds. Okay? Here, build this. Here. Is that it? Yes, that's exactly right. Deliver them really fast in that super fast cycle, and if they can't change their minds, they'll get it, and they might have a new idea. But it's not a change. It's just another requirement that goes on the backlog. It's just another thing. That type of very fast feedback allows you to really get that cadence going and deliver value fast. Feedback is the fuel for agility. It is the lifeblood. If you can't get really fast feedback, you cannot be agile. And when you look at almost everything that lean and agile principles say, they keep driving back to getting fast feedback on every level. We're talking requirements. I'll grab you right there. We want to grab a requirement, decompose the requirement, build it all fast, and come back to the user and say, was this what you wanted? Are you willing to pay 10 bucks a month for my service? If they're like, nah, not yet, boom, give me back again. Get another requirement out there. Let them understand really, really fast. It's fractal. It comes all the way down to when a developer is sitting down to write code, and they pick up this, they see the acceptance criteria, and they write a unit test first. Why? Because they get immediate feedback. They're getting feedback on the quality of their code almost instantaneously. It follows all the way up to the enterprise level. Get feedback fast. Yeah, question?
Okay, so in traditional waterfall, you have like requirement documents that get signed off. Is there a sign-off artifact in these kind of cycles?
Is there a sign-off artifact in these kind of cycles? There absolutely can be. And this is the place where you want to focus on shrinking that cycle time, but don't go extreme. You can be agile your way. You don't need to be agile in, you know, the extreme, crazy agile way. So you look at what you need, and do you need sign-offs? And the answer may be yes. If you fall under, in America, CFR 21 Part 11 compliance, right? It's part of the Food and Drug Administration for building information systems, or 520. You have all these things, and you have to, by law, to get your certification, you must take your requirements, sign off on them, have them physically approved. You can certainly do that. Nothing wrong with that at all. But don't let management say, we're going to have a meeting every 6 months. You just kind of shove that over, and we'll do all of our approvals at once in 1 4-hour meeting. That's baloney, because now you're losing your really fast side. Mm-hmm. Sure. How do you sign off on a set of work items that end up deploying? Let's take the management level where we have an epic. It could just be on the Kanban board, a dragging from one state to the next state. That's the approval state. If you don't need like official regulatory sign off with an electronic signature, that might be good enough. And that transition then triggers the flow down where all those user stories are going to start to be built. It could be much more formal, where you make that transition state and the definition of done says, in order to do this, you need to output all your requirements to a Word document, upload it to SharePoint, and digitally sign it there. Could very well be. That's that how that handles. Keep it light. Keep it light. And another question. Yeah?
Typically, where does your interaction designer fit into this whole cycle?
Where does your interaction designer come in? Your UX specialist, your user experience person, the person who has an architecture. In fact, where do architects fit? Right? Do we do architecture in Agile? I hear no, I hear yes, I hear maybe. Yes. Do I hear yes? Let's see yeses. Noes. Oh, I heard a no. I swear I heard a no. They looked around and saw too many yeses. Yes, you do. You do do. Yes. Architecture's okay in Agile. The right balance of architecture. If you do a big design up front, you're delaying feedback, right? But if you don't provide any architecture, you're increasing rework. You have two extremes. Somewhere in between, you've got this nice, happy medium where you can get the right amount of architecture. You have to fight it out between the two of you. I've got ideas on that. Cheryl and I do an enterprise agility course, and it's probably in there that's the best resource for that. Let's talk about some of the feedback specifically now in demos. The product owner and PowerPoint storyboarding, customers, I'm going to show you user voice. How many of you have seen user voice? Yeah, if you've submitted recommendations to Microsoft, you might have seen it. And feedback client. We'll talk about some of those as demos. So first I'm going to start with PowerPoint storyboards. And there's a lot of different ways you can do this. I'm going to start with just a PowerPoint, a raw PowerPoint deck. And we're going to go with well, let's just get this here. And file new. And before we start with PowerPoint storyboarding, I want to talk about why. We've made a switch. The world is becoming agile. I mean, it's kind of the accepted way to deliver software. Whether we do it in the requirements phase or not, we're delivering software in some agile fashion. And there was this move towards user stories that was really forceful. Really, really forceful. And we used to have these big requirements that had these mock-ups in them. And then we went to this, now it's got to fit on a 3x5 card, got to fit on a 3x5, and we lost something. And what we lost is this whole picture worth 1,000 words, this easy mock-up where we can see, what did you mean? What's the flow you're talking about? There's a swing back in industry saying, we're going to accept some of those. So let's accept some. And to do so, we're going to take and we can use PowerPoint storyboarding. Now, why PowerPoint? Why not Visio? Visio's the tool for this, right? It's brilliant. It's so powerful, all sorts of things. You can automate it. Why PowerPoint? Anyone? Everyone owns it. And I can build something in storyboarding, and I can send it to someone who doesn't have any license at all. They open it up, they can look at it, make comments, change it, you know the deal. So it's this really, it's a nice tool. So I have some ideas, frankly, on how to, how many of you have done an eval? Ah! Really? An eval of a speaker? Sorry, how many of you have evaluated a speaker session? How many of you have tried but have not been able to? There's a few. Not as many as last year. That's great. So I have some ideas for improvement. I want to improve the review, experience. And I'm just doing this in PowerPoint. And I'm going to come over here, create a new slide, and I just want just a, I'll probably go in and just change this to a blank slide. We don't really need much here. And then I'm going to go over to my storyboarding session and view my shapes, and I'm going to just mock up what I think would be a great addition to this. So now there's already stuff out there, so I'm going to utilize that. But if I look over here at my shapes, it's just a very easy way for me to do some mock-ups. So I'm going to scroll down here. Let's look for a web browser. I'll drag a web browser over, drop it over here. And while I'm at it, I'm going to stretch it out so it fits real nicely on my screen. I could go in up here and type in the URL. What is the URL to submit feedback? channel9.msdn.com/something/something. I don't know what it is. Something like that. Tech ed somewhere in there. So we have that. Now, I already have an idea, and there's already a code out there, so let's actually pop out and find that. Let's go to Channel 9, and I've got Tech Ed North America, and I'm signing in. Here I am. I've got this whole layout here, and I see when I go here to fill out my evals, I can search for it and then find it. Well, frankly, I want an easier way to find it. So I'm going to go in here, and I'm going to take a screenshot of this thing by simply going over to my PowerPoint and reaching up to insert. I love this. Microsoft added this. This is very nice. Where is my screenshot? There it is. Grab a screenshot of TechEd, drop it right in here. Let me go up and quick trim it a little bit. I want to crop it, get rid of some of the things that were on it, like that. That's good. Stretch it out. Drop it in here. Good enough. We got something that looks reasonably good. Now, I want to add a link right down here. So I'm going to scroll down, and I want to put a link right here by feature that says review recent sessions. Right? You're going to step out of here, and as soon as you step out, there's a bunch of recent sessions that closed. But it's not an overwhelmingly big list. It's a pretty small list. So you can just rush out and grab it. So let's grab one of those and do recent lists. And I'm going to go up here and do, I'm going to want to do a hyperlink. You grab a hyperlink, throw it over here, and we'll say evaluate recent sessions. And we might throw in another hyperlink over here, right here, that says evaluate my sessions. Right? Because some of you signed up and have them on your calendar. Well, how much easier would it be to just click that and go in right from here? You hit the home page, boom, you're in. I might want to put a note on here. I could put a note. Grab a sticky note, slap it out here somewhere that says something like, for recent sessions, use the last time block only. Okay. Something like that. I can add some notes to it. And then I might want to go in and add some animations. I have a click maybe that I want to use. So I'm going to grab a click and stretch it over here. And you can grab this end here, stretch it on down. So I can reach over and make it look like I'm clicking a button. Because right? Picture's worth 1,000 words. You throw some animation on it, you start to get workflow. You start to understand what workflow looks like. When I click evaluate recent sessions, I want to go to the next page. And on this next page, again, we might do some things like throwing in our web browser. Once again, putting it out, stretching it in, making it look nice, etc. I might then want to throw on a, I'll just show you. There's a lot of these nice little things to make it right, make it real easy. Might grab a data grid, but I'm going to grab a data grid in a moment. Before I grab a data grid, let's grab a tab group, a vertical tab group, because that looks totally cool. It's going to bring us to a page with a vertical tab group, and the tabs are going to have like things like this. They say ALM track, etc. Might have the tracks on the side, and then we can drop in a data grid. Throw on a data grid, yada, yada, yada. Those types of things. We can put buttons in here. We can put text in here. And while I'm at it, do you guys know about this? If I go in and insert a text box, text area, like so, this isn't going to fit in the data grid, but just bear with me here. You know that you can do equals lorem. I want two paragraphs of lorem. Isn't that awesome? That has absolutely nothing to do with requirements, by the way, but but I just think that's fun and cool. So the idea here is that you get this and you can set it all up to do some kind of nice stuff like that. Now, you push F5, you send it to someone, they push F5, and here's what they see. I want to improve the user experience. What were you thinking about that? Well, at TechEd, I really want to, you know, add these two fields. You might put pointers, highlight, whatever. But notice, I've got a mouse there. I click the mouse, and it moves over nicely and clicks that and brings us to the next page. So we can now see what the next place, what's the workflow look like. I bring these up because these tools are out of the box. They're available for you as business analysts, as you as developers, you as testers, you as just a regular stakeholder that wants to provide an idea to the company. You can do some of these things, get that PowerPoint storyboard out there and let people just nail it. Just let them hop in, do something with it, play with it, and get it out the door. Okay. Any questions on PowerPoint storyboarding? There's a couple things you need to do with a storyboard, however, and you need to save this thing, right? And I'm going to save it on my computer in my stories folder. And at that point, we can also link this. That was a shared location. We can then link that up to TFS in the cloud, potentially. Or we can put it in SharePoint, we can put it up in SkyDrive, and we can link it out to a location, to one of our work items, like we saw before, where I had a work item right there that I could just simply open up. It can be linked to those work items. Yeah, love those things. Questions on storyboarding? Before I leave, my very next demo is really just going to be going to take a look at user voice. So the next part of feedback you need to get is at user voice or some other tool. The world can provide you feedback. Now, TFS is wonderful inside your organization for people to provide, like, here's a bug, here's a bug, here's a bug, here's a bug, and they can give you those bugs. And they can lay out all the bugs that you want or new feature requests, et cetera. And you've got all that ideas from people who are in your domain, who are in your company. But once your product's out, you all of a sudden are going to have a whole bunch of people angry at you for one reason or another. And you want to give them a way to vent or you want to give them a way to recommend new ideas because you can start to crowdsource some of those great ideas. And user voice does that. If you look up here, this is customer feedback for Northwest Cadence. There's some suggestions here. I can go in and contact support and say, my TFS server is acting strangely. My code, check-ins, or whatever. You can submit these messages and kind of have that worked out so you can get this feedback very, very rapidly. In addition, you can give feedback and have suggestions. And people can then go in, and once you have suggestions, they can start to go in and vote those suggestions up and down, provide votes for those suggestions. You probably see that in Connect and other things with Microsoft, where you can vote things up and down. You have 10 votes, and you can suggest what Microsoft should be working on next. For TFS, number one suggestion, anyone? Project rename. Ooh, you're good. Renaming a project. It's been the number one suggestion since 2005. Violetta, take note. And what? Oh, my goodness. And a checkbox. I'd like it, rather than a drop down that says yes or no, I'd love a checkbox. Any other ideas? This is fast feedback, right? Violetta's sitting right here taking notes. This is your opportunity. Sorry to put you on the spot. You should get swamped afterwards. Everyone's going to come and talk to you. Ah! All right. User voice, we just demoed. What? Absolutely perfect timing, because before the final demo, I'm going to take a bunch of questions. Then we'll jump into the final demo. Yes? Yeah, okay. So the question is, how do my developers find out what's on user voice, besides just going out there and reading and tying those together? Or that the user stories they're working on solves a particular problem out there. So every recommendation has a URL. Sorry. That's not a really good answer. There's not a clear linkage yet between user voice and TFS, but both of them have absolutely wonderful APIs. So CodePlex would be a great place to put that. What's your name? Paul? We'll be looking for it, Paul. Yes? So we've got a requirement that we're putting into production. I'm going to rephrase. And in that requirement, we're pushing through some stuff, and we're building some code. And one of the things is it's got to go into performance testing environment. It's got to go into the user acceptance testing environment. It's got to go into the security testing environment. But not all requirements have to go through all phases. How do we address that? Is it with states? That's a difficult problem. I tend to extend the project to do that. Or I use tasks underneath, saying which ones it's gone through, potentially. It doesn't bifurcate. TFS doesn't let you come in, split into three parallel activities on your Kanban board, and then collapse back to one. There are tools that do that, but TFS isn't one of them. I create tasks. Yep, validated in environment X, validated in environment Y, validated in environment, et cetera. And then I've got, if you want, you create a link type to tie those together and a query, and then you can prevent people from actually dragging from one state to the next if those three things aren't met, potentially. Other questions? Yes?
Yeah, you suggested developing requirements faster than they could think of new ones, but I think we've all experienced a little bit of escalation here that as you start delivering faster, they start asking faster. how do you kind of suggest, where do requirements stop? Or how do you keep, how do you prevent a feedback loop of just your never-ending requirements just keep coming back in?
So the question, I like the question, I'm delivering them faster than, and then all of a sudden people love my product and they keep asking for more things. I'm summarizing. How do I get control of that? Once I start going faster, people are going to ask faster, 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 faster. How do I stop that? How do I get my arms around it so that I don't have a backlog that's 10,000 items? Because a backlog of 10,000 items is useless. Right? Again, it's way too long for you to deliver things. It's a good problem to have. Really highly engaged people who are using your product and are making requests and changes is a very good problem to have. But you still run into the problem of too many things in your backlog. I've worked with companies, and I love the way they did this. They have 30 bugs. That's the max they ever have. Someone comes in with a new bug. This isn't a feature, this is a bug. And they're like, okay, which bug goes? And they drop a bug off. And they're like, hey, it'll come back. Yeah. If it's important, it'll make its way back. And it's such an interesting take on that because it eliminates some of the needs they have to get on top of these massive bugs that they know they're not going to fix. If you know you're not going to fix a bug in a year, just close it and call the people up and say, we're sorry, but you just work around because nothing we're going to do to fix it. It's okay to do that. You're just not going to be able to rename team projects. I'm sorry. I'm just letting you know. I mean, we can do that, right? It's okay to not handle everything. Because as people know you're moving fast, they really appreciate that. And you can say no. And do say no. Do say no to things that aren't strategic, that fall low on your priority list. It'll come back if it's important. This goes back to another research project that was done by Capers Jones that I really liked. And in that research project, he found that... People preferred, they thought the companies had higher quality that fixed fewer bugs, but fixed them faster than companies who fixed more bugs, but on a longer cycle. So if you have to have a preference, focus your energy on fixing bugs really, really fast and getting that feedback out. So when people look at your change log, they're like, oh, wow, oh, they fixed the bug Friday. Oh, and another one on Friday, and another one next Friday. That fast cadence gives people a perception of high quality, even if your company has more bugs than a competing company that's fixing things very slowly. This is an interesting psychological behavior for people. So just pay attention to that. I'll take one more question before we go into the last demo. Yes?
Can you comment a little bit on co-location of teams and also infusing some offshore development team with a co-located team?
Sure. Co-location is all about fast feedback. It's all about turning right over to Anthony and saying, hey, what did you mean, Anthony? Or, dude, let's go grab lunch. It's just that really fast. We can bond. We can be fast. We really can bond as a team. It's not always possible. When you start to go offshore, especially offshore, but it could just be across the street, it could just be on the floor up, to be honest. When you start moving a floor up, your two teams are separated by a floor, they're not going to talk nearly as much. When they're separated by a continent or an ocean, they're going to talk even less. And it's very, very difficult. My recommendation on having run just a ton of Agile adoptions is please don't treat your offshore teams as the second best teams. Get them totally involved. If you are offshoring to save money, you're probably going to be disappointed. If you are offshoring because you cannot find talent in America and you're building another team elsewhere, you can't find the talent you need here, you are probably going to be treating them well, and you'll integrate them into the fold, and you'll get what you're looking for. But for cost reduction, I just don't see it happening when we're looking at places. The hourly rates are low, but if you're not constantly flying back and forth, you're missing out on that ability to build a team. And that's so important for development in an Agile organization. All right, let's move over. Let's hit the next one. It's the last demonstration. Northwest Cadence is small. I'm a co-founder, and I'm married to the president. Right? So there's certain advantages. That was a giggle. If I have a question about priority, or I need some advice, or something like that, I'll be able to talk to it over dinner, when we're laying down. I can figure it out. I can get that feedback. Cheryl, on the other hand, doesn't hang out at our house a lot. She's not just hanging out every night, right? So how does Cheryl get feedback from Lori? Well, if you're like most organizations, go out to the Outlook calendar, open it up. Looks like she's available day after next. Set up a half-hour time frame. That is not fast feedback. And Cheryl takes her PowerPoint up, sits down in front of Lori, fires it up, and says, what do you think? And Lori starts providing feedback. There's a lot of stuff that happens. You can't do it in faster than half an hour. That breaks fast feedback. We love this tool inside of Northwest Cadence. That's why I'm wrapping it up at the end, because it is such a powerful tool. It's the feedback client. And the feedback client, we're going to go right into a demo. This is our final demo. And I've got a, let me flip over now. I've got a request, and you can just pop up online on TFS Preview. You can do it locally. You click request some feedback, and it sends out an email that says, hey, I want your feedback. How discoverable is the session rating site? How easy is it to find your session? Sorry, it's telling me I need to be here. How do you rate the actual rating experience? That's kind of meta. You go in here, and you just say, I'll start my feedback session. I'm game. And what happens when you start your feedback session is it pops up this feedback tool that reaches out to the cloud, connects, and says, all right, start providing feedback. And the first thing it says is open Bing and figure out how to submit a session. Why? Because I'm asking you to figure it out. I'm not giving you the URL. I want you to figure it out. So I click this. It fires up Bing. Awesome. I click next, and it says, how discoverable is this session site? Notice I'm getting guidance. We're trying to understand the ease of use of the application, how easy it is for you to find the website that allows session ratings. No problem. Right at Bing, right? North America Tech Ed 2013. Perfect. Very first hit is not what I'm looking for. There we go. Tech Ed. That's got to be the place. So I click it. Register. Review. I'm not seeing it. I'm having troubles. So I'm going to just make a quick note. Can't find it right away. Going to video. At this point, I'm going to start recording screen with a voice. And now I've got screen with a voice going, and I'm talking to it. It's recording it, and I'm saying, I don't see it right off the bat. I'm expecting there's a review button here. That I don't see the review button. There's the register button. There's the content. Ah, content. Sweet. That's the place. I want to evaluate my pre-con. I will drop in here to pre-cons. Scroll down to find the pre-con. Okay, this isn't as bad as I thought. It's pretty easy. Here it is. I'm ready to go on the pre-con. And where's the link to evaluate? I'm not seeing the link. Notice I'm talking to the developer at this point. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the dev. This video is being recorded. And I'm looking at it going, I can't find this thing. Maybe I need to log in. So let me go register. Well, not register. There's a login somewhere down here, I remember. Go down and find the login place. You get the idea. It's taking me a little while to find it. I finally go to content and say, what about the content catalog? And bingo, I'm at channel 9 to do my evals for Tech Ed. Why isn't it at the Tech Ed site? So I'm complaining about this, and I can stop the video and say, okay, I get it. I finally find it. I'm going to stop it. I'm going to rate this item as a 1. It is totally not discoverable. If I type in Tech Ed evals, I want it to show up as Bing my first hit. It's not discoverable. I don't like it. Giving it 1 star. Next, how easy is it to find the session you want to rate? Now, once you've discovered the site that does the ratings, how easy is it to do the session? Well, let me go down and say, well, I guess I can sort by level, day, session type. Let's go down to pre-conferences. Click filter. Notice I don't need to record the whole thing. In there, I can find it. I find it very nicely. Scroll down. Looking down. Nope, next page. Okay, I found it. That's not bad. There's the enterprise agility is not an oxymoron. I'm good. I might take a screenshot of that. Highlight it up like this. Double click it. Maybe grab a pen in here and say, point to this thing here. You'll notice that it just appears right there and says, that wasn't bad. I'm going to give that a 4 stars. That was a pretty easy search. I'd still like those 2 buttons, though. Just evaluate it. Click next. And then lastly, how do you find the actual rating? You click evaluate. Boom! How easy was this? Submit. Boom! Love it! Man, that was easy. So I can go in here, give that one 5 stars. Really, really easy. And next, it's ready to submit it. Submit and close. And it is being uploaded. It is linked back, because I linked the request. It's linked back to my requirement. Developer can open it up, look at all those evaluations, understand, whoa, this is not discoverable. Let me get on the phone and call those people over in the other development side and say, can you add a link to my site? Easy as that. Boom. We're in. Everyone's happy. Do you guys know how to do evals now? Yeah, you see why I did this, right? I have one thing to wrap. At Northwest Cadence, we use this all the time. Why? Because Andrew, who we work with, fires up a PowerPoint slide, throws it out on SkyDrive, throws a link to me, requests the PowerPoint review, bam! I open it up, open up the PowerPoint, open up a recording, and say, I don't like the way you're doing this. Please don't capitalize so much. Don't bold this. Save it. I might not even make the changes. Feedback goes back. He gets notified very quickly. Why does it matter? Because I can provide feedback in 5 minutes instead of finding a half-hour schedule on my calendar or on Lori's calendar, even harder than mine. And because we can do that, we can get feedback very, very rapidly. How much does it cost to provide feedback, licensing-wise? Big old goose egg, zero. It's free. Spread this throughout your organization. I am not kidding. This is, I don't care if you're not using TFS for anything else. I'm serious. Slap it up and use it for feedback. It is an enormously powerful tool because you just record things. It just gets that feedback going. So bottom line that I want to talk about, it's just, it comes back to feedback. Get that feedback going very, very rapidly, and you'll be successful. Now, a couple things. There's a free plan out here. You saw me using the cloud. Love the cloud version. You've got cloud VMs now that I just wish to tell you about very briefly. And some resources. Channel 9, so you can do your evals. Awesome resource. And one last thing. Complete an evaluation to win this. Where do you complete your evaluation? If you have this, this was an awesome requirement at the user story team level that someone put in to give you this. I love it. Scan the QR code and you can do an eval. Thank you so very much. If there's any additional questions, please come up and ask, and I'll happily cover them.